So our next speaker is Richard Pillins, who's going to talk to us about the sort of work he's been doing with tagging of whale sharks and what some of the behaviours from those tags show us. Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for coming, everyone. So today's talk is just a brief summary of the progress that we've made trying to understand whale shark movement and some of the work that we've been doing to get estimates of population status, which Matt alluded to in a far more succinct manner than probably I will. I want to acknowledge my fellow co-authors and the team that I work with. It's a pretty intensive process doing what we do, both in the lab and in the field. So whale sharks, basically, why are we doing this? Whale sharks are the largest fish in the ocean. They can reach up to 16 metres in size. The list is as endangered by IUCN. The population globally is declining. We know that they're highly migratory. There's no genetic difference between, say, the West Australian coastline and the African coastline, and there's no difference between, say, whale sharks in the Philippines and whale sharks at Ningaloo, genetically. At Ningaloo, they aggregate seasonally. It's a fairly busy time of year, and it's a very profitable time of year. Whale sharks have been estimated to generate about $12 million directly to the local economy, and it's about the same amount of money indirectly. At Ningaloo, the sharks that aggregate annually are almost all immature males, so they're sort of males around 6 metres or less in length. So we don't know where the big females and where the big males are. Having said that, some big males like Stumpy have been coming back to Ningaloo for 20 years and they mature. So while they are the biggest fish in the ocean, we really know very little about them. There has been a little bit of tagging done at Ningaloo over the years, and the movement away from Ningaloo outside of the aggregation period is highly variable, but they're not moving as far as we'd expect from the genetic results. So they're not moving all the way to Mozambique or Madagascar, or they're not moving to the Philippines. So we're hoping by tagging more, we might be able to demonstrate some of those movements. So the primary objectives of the Ningaloo Outlook Project when we started were primarily around movement. So when, where and why do they go? And we're going to address that through tagging. We're interested in things like, are there sex-specific differences? Do males go to different places to females? Do big males go to different places to little males? And why do they go to those places? Are they going there because there's more food there? Are they going there for mating purposes? Are they going there because it's too cold in some places and nice and warm in others? And we can use some of the detailed dive data that the satellite tags collect to help us understand that. As the sort of project went along, we're also interested in how many there were. There have been some estimates of population size in Ningaloo that have been done using mark recapture from the photographs. Population estimates around 400 to 500 animals, but we know that there's about 1,200 animals that visit Ningaloo annually. Well, not annually, over the 20 years that photographs have been taken. So the problem with the photo ID stuff is that you can only really estimate the resident population, but we know that the Ningaloo whale sharks form part of a massive Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean population. So we're hoping that some of the genetic techniques will be able to inform us how many there are. Just making sure that you're seeing what I'm seeing. So how do we do all this? Basically, a team of people goes out. We've got a pilot flying up in the sky. Lovely Tiff, she finds the sharks for us, tells us where they are. We jump in front of them. We've got a stereo video camera that basically gives us really accurate length estimates of how big the shark is. We get a sex, whether it's a male and a female. We take photos of the left and right side for IDs, and we also take a little tissue sample. So this is just a clip of... So we've sexed the animal, we've taken the photos. We now just want to get a little tissue sample, which is just a tiny plug using a little biopsy needle. This shark was a bit difficult. Most of them are on the surface. This one's down about 15 metres. Makes it a bit more challenging. So that's a biopsy sample, and now the satellite tag goes in. So the problem with whale sharks is that they have really thick skin, so we need to punch the tag anchor in nice and deep so we can get a long enough track from the tag before it gets ripped out by a shark or a bigger fish, which unfortunately happens quite a bit. So once we've done that, we come back to the lab. The stereo doves are basically two cameras that are calibrated, and by clicking on the head and the tail, we can get really precise estimates of how big the animal is. So we do this for all the animals. We identify all of them, and so far we've got 186 tissue samples from the whale sharks, and pretty much all of those we've been able to get an ID. So there's a couple of ways you can do it. We use Wild Book, which gives us a unique identification of that animal, how long it's been coming to Ningaloo for, so we've got a history of it. And we also get length and sex for most of the samples. So just a quick comparison. So this is the length frequencies of the animals that we sampled in 2017, both males and females. And you can see here that lots of males. Most of the sharks that are mature are probably between 8.5 plus meters. So anything less than that is an immature male. For females, we're a little less certain. One of the interesting things is that in 2017, about 14% of the sharks were female. In 2018, about 25%. So there's definitely something going on in terms of when different sharks, but also different sexes will visit Ningaloo. So the tissue samples that we're collecting will hopefully be used to estimate population size using something that CSIRO's pioneered, firstly on white sharks, but also on grey nurse and spear-toothed sharks more recently. And basically how it works is that through genetics we can identify if animals share a parent, so whether they're a half-brother or a half-sister. And the smaller, the bigger the population, the less chance of finding two siblings is. And as adult survival increases, so too does the chance that two siblings are from the same parent. And so we're hoping that in time that headline will change to whale sharks. The only difference in those two photos is that there's a person in that one, and there wasn't a person in the one before. So whale sharks are a little bit easier to sample than white sharks. So that's the genetic stuff that we want to do and the work that we're hoping to do in the future. Now we're going to focus on the satellite tagging that we've done over the last 4 years. So unlike turtles, which are really easy to study and a nice animal, that's pretty much what whale sharks do a lot of the time. That's the satellite tag, that's the surface. The tag needs to be up here to work. So satellite tagging whale sharks is tricky business. We don't always hear from the tag. Months can go by where the shark's swimming from here to Indonesia and we don't hear from it, and then it'll pop up. So what we get is sometimes incomplete data. We also get big sharks and other fish that come and basically rip the tags off the shark. And so we've got a shark that's swimming around for a couple of months and all of a sudden the tag just disappears and it's in the gut of something and we never hear from it again. So it's not without its challenges. Neither is tagging turtles, Matt, but at least they have to breed. So we've tagged 20 males and 20 females. So we've really tried to tag equal numbers of males and females. And we've made a fairly big effort to try and tag sexually mature males to see if they're going somewhere that the little guys aren't, to maybe unlock the secrets about where whale sharks are mating. There's been very few little tiny whale sharks recorded around the world, and most of those have been found in open ocean areas. So that was one of the aims was to try and do that. So where do they go? So this is all the 40 animals that we've tagged. The years are in different colours. So there's a huge both latitudinal and longitudinal spread. We've documented the first movement of a whale shark from Ningaloo into Gulf of Carpentaria. I think that's the most northerly movement of a whale shark. It's a shark named after Danny. Up into the Arafura Sea, just between the West Papua and Indonesian border. But basically, it looks like there might be something happening in different years, but a lot of that's just driven by the individual variation that we see on a year-to-year basis and the length of time that the tags stay attached. So in the early days, the techniques that we used for getting the tags to stay attached were probably not as good as what they are now. Our average deployment time is about 140 days, and the longest we've had a tag attached is about 350 days. So we're getting better at it. So one of the other things we can look at is seasonal movement. So what do the sharks do throughout the year? And basically we can see that sort of throughout the peak season, all the sharks. This is a selection of about 11 sharks that moved quite widely. So in June, the sharks are sort of concentrated around the Ningaloo up to sort of Barrow Island area. And then as the year goes on, they sort of disperse more widely. And this has quite important implications for the, you know, the risk of ship strikes. About 14% of our sharks have moved into international waters. And although whale sharks are protected internationally, there is still illegal fishing that happens in some of these countries. What about males and females? Are they any different? Pretty much no. There is some variation. Again, there's a little male that went into the Gulf Carpentaria. Danny was up here. But broadly, males and females seem to be doing very similar things. So the red dots are the sexually mature males. So the big guys, we can tell whale sharks are sexually mature because of their claspers. Basically, the big males have got huge, big, long claspers that extend well past the ventral fin. And we can see here that the big males don't really seem to be going to different areas than the females and the smaller males. What about something like sea surface temperature? So there's one of the theories is that whale sharks are sort of avoiding really hot water. This is the 10 animals that we tagged in 2018, and basically the sea surface temperature is different colours. And when the sharks start to move, you can see that some sharks are going up into, you know, really hot water, up towards Ashmore Reef, whereas other sharks are sort of down towards Shark Bay and still at Ningaloo. So the temperature range of individuals spans about 10 degrees. So there doesn't appear to be any distinctive link with temperature and where the sharks are. There's a lot of individual variation, and it's much the same for chlorophyll. So these are the same sharks. Some of the sharks do seem to be staying near the coast where there's high chlorophyll concentrations, so large amounts of food. But certainly when they go into some of the more open ocean areas, there's very low productivity in those regions. So there's no distinctive kind of pattern with where the animals go. But we're still developing models to look at that. I spoke earlier about, you know, what sort of vertical patterns do they do? How deep are they diving? While the tags that we deploy do collect depth information and temperature information, the data that we get back from satellites is fairly minimal. So we really need to get the tags back in order to get the data off them. This is a tag that Danny and Joe found. This was Big Mama's tag. Some of you might have heard about Big Mama's story. But so far we've had two tags recovered prior to 2008. And then this year we had Susie, another tag which was recovered. This is just Susie's tracks. So she was tagged at Ningaloo, moved up to Ashmore Reef, back to Ningaloo, back up to sort of Rolly Shoals, back to Shark Bay, and then back to Ningaloo. And that black dot is where the tag detached. Pretty cool story. So the tag detached here. It then floated north about 200 k's over 18 days. And then luckily for us, it took a sharp right-hand turn to the east and it washed up on Jane's Bay. Jane's Bay is a bit of a mecca. You can see all the flotsam on the beach. And the stuff that washes up there is both national and international origin. So just lucky for us that the tag happened to sort of go past this little suction black hole that seems to suck in all the trash in the ocean. Thankfully for us, the turtle rangers were there and went on the beach and got our tag back for us. So we've now got three complete tracks from whale sharks that have been, you know, undertaken some fairly significant movements. So this is the data that we got back from Susie's tag. So on the left axis, we've got depth. And then each of these are basically daily plots, and they're color-coded by temperature, so red's sort of 30 degrees. And as they dive deeper, the water gets colder. So Susie was in water from about 30 to 4 degrees. And then on the right-hand axis, it's just the distance from Ningaloo in kilometers. So we can see that while they're at Ningaloo, they're in sort of 28 degree water, which was warmer than normal in June. Up to Ashmore Reef, sort of 30 degrees, back down to Ningaloo, down to Dirk Hartog, back to Ningaloo, Rolly Shoals, Ningaloo and Dirk Hartog. And when they're in the open ocean, so away from Ningaloo, they can obviously access these really deep waters. So what are they doing? Are they, when they're in different places, do they use the water column differently? Are they diving differently when they're at, say, Ningaloo versus Dirk Hartog? And the answer from Susie is yes, they're using very, very different habitats. So when Susie was at Dirk Hartog, she spent most of her time in 3 to 6 metres of water, whereas at Ningaloo, she spent a lot of time in 0 to 3 metres, so sort of at the surface, just below the surface, where it's slightly deeper. And at Ningaloo, she spent a lot more time in between 50 and 100 metres of water. When we look at the individuals, there's significant variation in how they use depth. So these are the three recovered tags. And you can see that while there is difference between the animals, there's a fairly distinct pattern. So we've got a lot of animals, say, using that 0 to 6 metres of water, and then there's a bit of a gap, and then there's a lot more use of say, 20 to 100 metres. And the reason for that is basically day and night. So what we see is that animals are diving to deeper waters more often at night, and generally during the day they're at the surface or undertaking very rapid deep dives. So this is just an example of that. So during the day, Big Mama, most of the time at the surface, whereas at night, most of the time, there's say between 50 to 100 metres of water. One of the other interesting things we can look at from these tags is how fast they're moving up and down in the water column. And this can give us insights to their feeding behaviour. If they find a patch of food, say, at 70 to 100 metres, they're more likely to be sort of zooming up and down through that food. And so we can see the speed that they are moving up and down through the water column. And it can be very useful to interpret what they're doing. So this is just a little animation of Susie's tag. So basically the red dot on the map will show where she is. And then the rate of the vertical movement up and down the water column will go from purple, which is basically she's just moving on the same plane, to red. And this axis is clipped to 140 metres, just so we can see what's going on. And you can see that as it moves around, as it moves to Ashmore and then back to Ningaloo, the rate of vertical movement changes a lot depending on where it is and also how close to the bottom it's swimming, and that's dependent on the bathymetry. So there's models that we can plug all this data into that basically tell us how deep the water is, where it was, and that's that grey line that you can see on the bottom there. And so we're starting to generate a better understanding of how whale sharks use their habitat, where they feed, and what they're doing when they undertake these migrations backwards and forwards. Another thing that we've noticed is that at night time, the sharks are sort of doing these really consistently slow up and down movements, but the movements are fairly methodical and fairly slow between the surface and say 60 metres of water, whereas during the daytime they do much deeper dives, but they're really fast. So they're basically motoring down, getting to 300 or 400 metres, stopping, and then swimming back up at the same speed that they swam down, and then they come back at the surface, have a bit of a rest. So very different behaviours at the day and night. So what does this all mean moving forward and in terms of the study? So obviously the movement data is very important in terms of both national and international whale shark understanding, in terms of risk to ship strike, how often sharks are moving into international waters, what are the threats, how much time do they spend there. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to unlock the mystery of where they go to reproduce, and there doesn't appear to be any difference certainly between the males, big males, small males, or the females that we've tagged. The recovery of the tags has been an enormous boost to our understanding of their vertical movement. We haven't been able to demonstrate some of the sort of previously described behavioural traits that whale sharks were thought to display, but we've revealed some really interesting new ones. Moving forward, our main focus is going to be on estimating population size through close kin. CSIRO estimated the white shark population with 103 samples. We're now at 186, and we should be at 286 in a few months. So we should be in a fairly strong position, at least within the Australian population, to obtain estimates, and we're hoping to expand to a sort of a global Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean study, so we can estimate the size of that population. And just like to thank the BHP CSIRO partnership. The DPOR office has been enormously supportive. not only in recovering tags, but also just for logistical support, advice. There's some people there that know a lot about whale sharks. Some of them are in this room. The Ames Whale Shark team, Michelle and Kim, I'll still owe Kim a carton of beer if he's here, for recovering that tag. I haven't forgotten about that. Ningaloo Overlay Asian, our pilot Tiff, is amazing. And Tim and Belinda for their ongoing support. Thank you.